Thanks very much, Paul. This is my first visit to Toronto ever, and I'm enjoying it immensely. I've had great discussions today with many of you, or some of you in the audience, and I'm looking forward to more discussions today and perhaps tomorrow morning. I'm going to talk about a truly interdisciplinary arena of science, namely the interaction between climate and ecosystems. And I'm going to particularly focus on the two-way nature of that interaction, the fact that climate change can alter ecosystems, and ecosystems, when they change, can in turn feed back to influence the climate. The first slide is an acknowledgement of the many people that I've worked with on the material that I'm going to talk to you about today, a large group of wonderful graduate students, many, many undergraduates, and financial support from a variety of U.S. government institutions. The talk is divided into three parts. The first part is going to be a very quick overview of the global warming phenomenon. For some of you in this room, it will be a completely repetitive section of the talk. You know all the stuff I'm going to say in part one, but I'll go through it very quickly. I just want to make sure that we all are up to the same page on what the global warming problem is and why do we take it seriously. In the second part, I'm going to give also a very brief look at the issue of climate ecosystem feedbacks and try to persuade you based on some data sets, particularly the Vostok core data, that climate ecosystem feedback is a really potentially important phenomenon and that we have to understand it if we're going to really understand what global warming is going to look like over the next 100 years. And then in the third part, which will probably be at about half the whole talk, I'm going to tell you about some experimental work we're doing up in the Rocky Mountains, and the work will inform us about climate ecosystem feedback. What is global warming? The phenomenon is very oversimplified in a way captured here. Sunlight is the source of energy that drives the climate. Some sunlight is scattered off of clouds, and some reaches the Earth. Some of what reaches the Earth is scattered back to space, but some is absorbed, converted into heat. The heat would be radiated back out to space, and were it not for the presence of certain gases in the atmosphere, gases we call greenhouse gases, like water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane, if it weren't for those gases, the heat radiated from the surface would go straight out to space. Instead, heat is absorbed by those greenhouse gases and re-radiated back to the surface, and that contributes to additional warming of Earth's surface. Were it not for the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, if all of them were gone, the water vapor, the methane, the CO2, we would be much colder than we are, about 30 degrees colder. Greenhouse gases warm us, and the problem of global warming is a problem of too much of a good thing. And thickening the layer of greenhouse gases thickens this blanket, if you like, causing more heat to be radiated back to the surface. One of the greenhouse gases is carbon dioxide, and if you look at data on its concentration in the atmosphere, it's been steadily rising. If we go back to before roughly this period, we have indirect measures of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from trapped bubbles of ice, of carbon dioxide in ice cores and other surrogates. From here on, we have direct, very accurate measures of carbon dioxide. And you can see that the levels have increased dramatically, about 30% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Why? In part because of energy consumption and to a lesser extent because of deforestation. Here's a picture just showing you trends in the use of various kinds of energy sources, with gas, oil, and coal being the three there that contribute to the buildup of carbon dioxide. Deforestation contributes because when you cut down forest and replace it with, say, sugarcane fields, what happens is all the carbon that was stored in the trees is gradually decomposed or perhaps rapidly burned if the farmer is doing that and goes up into the atmosphere as CO2. If you look over a longer period of time, going back 400,000 years to the present, we see carbon dioxide levels going up and down in synchrony with the major glacial, interglacial periods. And today, because of fossil fuel burning, deforestation, we've moved the CO2 level up above what it has been over that 400,000-year record. These data come from trapped bubbles in the Vostok ice core, an ice core taken from Antarctica, which I'll return to shortly. What's the effect of the buildup of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide on climate? Well, the way climate scientists often pose the question is, what would happen if we doubled the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere relative to the, say, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution or relative to 1900? You can ask the question in different ways. You don't have to just focus on carbon dioxide. You can also ask, what if we also build up methane levels, nitrous oxide levels, and other greenhouse gas levels to an amount equivalent to a doubling of carbon dioxide? And the answer is there's two contributions to the warming. There's what's called the direct effect, which I showed you in that previous slide, just the effect of re-radiating heat back to the ground from the thickened layer of greenhouse gases. But then that warming, which is caused by the re-radiation, it's about 1 degree Celsius, that triggers additional effects called indirect or feedback effects. For example, there's the ice albedo feedback effect. A 1 degree warming will cause ice to melt. When ice melts on mountaintops or in the polar regions, what's exposed below the ice is darker than the ice. The darker surface, it absorbs more solar energy than the ice did. Ice is very reflective. And so by absorbing more solar energy, you heat the planet more, and that's a feedback. Another feedback is the increasing amount of water vapor that can be held in a warmer atmosphere. So we get a water vapor feedback. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. When you warm the atmosphere by this much, the atmosphere will store more water vapor, and then that will cause more warming because it's a greenhouse gas. Also, cloud effects can contribute to feedbacks. And these three feedbacks are the three dominant ones that are in our current general circulation models. The large computer models that project what the future might look like under different future levels of greenhouse gas. And there's uncertainty in the effects of these feedbacks, with the cloud feedback probably the most uncertain. And so to the 1 degree of direct warming, we get another 1/2 to 3.5 degrees of warming from feedback, leading to a projection total of between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees Celsius of warming if we double CO2. Right now, we've gone up 30%. We haven't doubled yet compared to the Industrial Revolution. Is, let's say, 4 degrees. Is that a big deal? Should we be worried about a 4-degree warming? Can we put it in context? Well, let's put it in the context of the last glacial interglacial cycle. If we go back 130,000 years ago, we come to an interglacial where temperatures were high, like they are now. And then we descended into an ice age. The ice age lasted a long time, and then we rapidly came out of that ice age, and here we are today. I haven't shown the current warming from the greenhouse, from the anthropogenic greenhouse effect on that slide. I'm just showing you up to, let's say, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And what you see is that between recent times and the depths of the last ice age, there was about a 6 degree Celsius change in temperature. So we warmed 6 degrees from the depths of the last ice age to the present, globally averaged. Some places were much colder than that this at the time of the last ice age, but this is a global average. Now with a global average warming of another 3 or 4 degrees, we're going to go up to somewhere up here by the time we've doubled CO2. And in the context of that change, it looks like a big deal. It's not as big as the change from the last ice age to the present, but it's maybe half as much. But that's a lot, because we know how different the planet was during the last ice age. This is the famous hockey stick graph that shows the recent warming trend in the context of reconstructed data over the last 1,000 years. There's a lot of argument about how good these reconstructions are, and very little argument about this part of the data set. And the question really is this an unusual event, or is it just part of the background noise? The way I've plotted it here, it looks like it's not part of the background noise, but to give credit to critics, there are people who criticize the way that data set was analyzed. Why should we believe the models that say that the warming from the greenhouse gases will lead to, let's say, a 3 degree warmer planet by the time CO2 is doubled? One thing we can do is look at what the models say should have happened already. And the models are pretty good. They get roughly the right global average warming from the 30% increase in CO2. But there's a lot more to it than just global average temperature. In fact, models predict that as the surface warms, the stratosphere should cool under building up levels of CO2. If CO2 levels rise, it predicts that temperatures should rise faster at nighttime than in daytime. They should rise faster in winter than in summer, and they should rise more at the high latitudes than in the low latitudes. Now, some of these predictions are not difficult to understand. I mean, it's the reason why high latitudes might warm more than low latitudes is that's where the ice albedo feedback operates. Some of these mechanisms or some of these patterns predicted by models under increasing carbon dioxide levels might also be predicted if the cause of that recent warming trend were a brighter sun. But some of them would not. If an increase in solar flux were the cause of the recent warming trend, we would expect temperatures to be rising more during the day than at night. But in fact, it's the other way around. They do rise more during the night than during the day. Stratosphere would not cool if the sun got brighter, but it is predicted to cool if carbon dioxide is the cause and the stratosphere is cooling as the surface is warming. So the fact that the observations down to that kind of level of detail match the model outputs, and these model outputs are very robust. These are not fine details of the predictions. The fact that the fingerprint matches gives us confidence that the models are saying something that we should take seriously. Why are we worried about the warming? This is just a list of some of the categories of impact that have been researched and are continuing to be researched. Sea level rise is, of course, going to happen as ice melts and also as seawater expands as it gets warmer. Wildfires in the West Coast, we're very concerned about this. Drier conditions can lead to serious problems with wildfire, particularly in urban areas where the Western United States has had lots and lots of problems recently. Human health impacts, the spread of either pathogens or the vectors that spread pathogens causing infectious disease, spreading from the tropics to the subtropics or the subtropics to the temperate. In many cases, diseases are held in check because of wintertime temperatures. go below freezing, the pathogens or their vectors can't survive. If you push the frost point northward, poleward, then you're going to have the potential to increase the area of the planet where infectious diseases that we now associate with the tropics will be found. Food production is a very important one, and the concern here is that higher temperatures will cause soils to be drier, which will parch our crops and require either much more use of irrigation water or we'll have diminished food supplies. In many parts of the world, there's no access to irrigation water. Farming is reliant on natural rainfall, and so that's a concern. And then there are ecological effects. Many ecologists studying this issue have predicted that we could be seeing from global warming an extinction episode comparable to what occurred 65 million years ago at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, when about half of all the species on Earth went extinct at the same time that the dinosaurs did. That was the result of a large asteroid impact. In this case, rapid warming of 3 or 4 degrees over the period of maybe 100 years could do a lot more damage than the warming that occurred when we came out of the last ice age, because that warming took place over 1,000 or more years, several thousand years. And so the rapidity of the warming is what has ecologists concerned, because species can't adapt as rapidly as the climate might change. Just to sort of finish this part of the discussion, here's a reconstruction of temperature events, temperature globally averaged over 1,000 years. And here we are today. This much warming has occurred. And here is what future energy policy will determine. There are energy consumption scenarios that give us as much as 6 degrees warming in the coming 100 years, or others that reduce it considerably if we make a transition to renewable solar energy, conservation of energy, and other solutions. So this is really the big uncertainty, and it's not an uncertainty as much in the climate models as it is in human behavior. Okay, let's turn to part two, and I want to look at climate ecosystem feedbacks with you, first in a general way, global perspective. So what's the idea? The idea is that climate change can occur because of building up of CO2 and other greenhouse gases, and as you warm the climate, you can affect species diversity, the relative composition of an ecosystem. If you have a forest with a mix of pine and spruce, you may find that 100 or 200 years of warming will change the proportions of pine and spruce. You may find also that certain ecological processes, most of them carried out by either plants or microorganisms, bacteria and fungi in the soil, will be altered by soil warming, soil drying. And these processes are critical because they govern the carbon cycle on Earth. That is, each year, plants take in the process of photosynthesis, an enormous amount of carbon dioxide, on the order of 100 gigatons of carbon in the form of carbon dioxide each year. And microbes decompose carbon in the soil from dead plant matter. They decompose carbon from the soil with a return flux of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And that flux of carbon back and forth between the atmosphere, the forests, and the soil is on the order of about 7 or 8 times larger than the flux of carbon dioxide from fossil fuel burning. So altering that cycle a little bit can have a big effect on the net amount of carbon going to the atmosphere, and therefore the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So as these ecological parameters change under climate change through changing soil carbon decay rates, drought stress, for example, altering species composition, the effects can feed back to climate. Changes in species composition can affect the surface albedo of the planet. You saw that picture in my opening slide where you had different colored flowers growing on the sides of a ravine. And those plants have hugely different albedo. The difference in the reflection coefficient between the darker and the lighter plants is on the order of about 10 or 12 watts per square meter, which is comparable to the direct forcing effect of doubling CO2. So, in fact, it's bigger than the direct forcing effect of doubling CO2. So by changing who's living where in the plant world, we can alter the amount of sunlight reflected back to space. I'll show you an example from an experiment about that shortly. As we alter soil processes, we can change the emissions of the net flux of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, which is produced by microbes in soil, and methane, which is also produced in soil and water. All of those can change as a result of ecological processes. So those are just some examples of feedback. Let me give you an example of an interesting, somewhat hypothetical, but plausible feedback that's deduced indirectly. If we look, we go back 10, 15,000 years ago, as the North American ice sheet was retreating from the northern tier of the United States and up through Canada, we can ask, can our current climate models predict the rate at which the ice sheet retreated? And it turns out, if you make an abiotic model of the climate, that is, without life in it, without forests, and you put under the retreating ice the rock and silt that we think was there, the albedo of that surface exposed by the retreating glacier, the ice sheet, was probably around 0.4. In other words, that surface reflected about 40% of the sunlight incident on it. The effect of a 40% albedo on the local climate in the vicinity of the edge of that retreating ice sheet yields a certain predicted rate of ice retreat. Turns out that the models that assume this give a predicted rate that's well below the actual rate at which the ice sheet retreated. But what happened is, behind the retreating ice, rather rapidly, spruce forests grew up. And spruce trees are dark. They have an albedo of about 0.1. They reflect only about 10% of the sunlight. So locally, they warm. And when you put the spruce trees into the model, you get something consistent with the actual rate. So those spruce trees weren't following the ice north. They were chasing the ice north. And if you don't have the ecology in the model, you're going to miss out on an important characteristic of climate change. Oops, climate change. Okay, now I want to turn to the Vostok Ice Core. This is from Antarctica. It's a 2 kilometer deep ice core taken out of the Antarctic ice shelf by an international team of scientists. This is not the full core. It goes back to about 800,000 years. What I'm showing here is just the last 160,000 years. So we had a glacial period, an interglacial, and then last ice age, and now we've come out of that last ice age in the last 20,000 years. And you can see there's a lot of noise in that record. It's not really noise, actually. A lot of this is explicable in terms of what's called the Milankovitch mechanisms, which are small but persistent changes in the amount and timing of solar flux reaching the Earth. The changes have to do with the shape of Earth's orbit around the Sun, which is periodic on a 100,000-year cycle, the tilt of Earth's axis, and the direction in space that Earth's axis points. And the effect of all of these is to induce variability in the temperature record shown here. And the problem with the Milankovitch explanation is it doesn't explain anything even close to the magnitude of temperature difference between the cool glacial and the warm interglacials. But there is an explanation, and it's based on another piece of data coming out of the Vostok ice core, which is the CO2 record. Because again, from the bubbles of trapped air, we can deduce what the atmosphere looked like. And what you see is that the carbon dioxide over 160,000 years varied tightly in synchrony with the temperature. There's a little bit of lag, but it's clearly an important observation that those two data sets look as much alike as they do. The question now is, could this explain this? And the answer is, yes, it can. But then you have to ask, what explains this? And the only thing we know of that explains this is this. So people weren't sitting around campfires burning coal and oil in those days. We know of no volcanic explanation for the CO2 variability. And in fact, what it looks like is that this is a feedback interaction with this causing this and this causing this. And it's a positive feedback. When it gets warmer, that positive feedback warms us more than just Milankovitch would. And when it gets colder, the positive feedbacks, again, work to amplify the rate of cooling. But the problem is that we don't understand the source of that carbon dioxide variability. And there's another problem. Believe it or not, none of this feedback is incorporated in our current general circulation models. So those projections I showed you for the amount of warming under doubled CO2 pretended that this did not exist. And the state of, if you look in the IPCC or in any document that's projecting what the world would look like under doubled CO2, let's say 50 or 100 years from now, it does not include a contribution from this positive feedback effect. Now, it may be that the positive feedback effect worked like a charm all through this period, but now it's going to just stop. For some reason, no more feedback, and we don't have to worry about it in the future. But that seems to me to be a pretty foolish thing to assume. And unless we understood the mechanism of that carbon interaction, we really haven't fully come to grips with what the future climate might look like. I want to take a moment out to do a little bit of the mathematics of feedback with you, because we're going to need it in order to understand more about the impossible importance of that effect. We have an input signal, which let's say is the 1 degree warming, the direct forcing of 1 degree from doubling CO2 without any feedbacks. Then, when you warm the biosphere, you melt some ice, you increase the water vapor in the atmosphere, and you get what's called a gain factor, a feedback gain. And it's like if you're an engineer, you've seen diagrams like this in electronic circuitry. And so the effect of the feedback is to give an output signal that will be bigger than the input if it's positive feedback, or smaller than the input if it's negative feedback. And the way this is described mathematically is the output is the input plus once around the feedback loop plus twice around the feedback loop, and we can sum that infinite series, and it's the input divided by 1 minus g, provided g is less than 1 so that the series converges. And if g is less than 0, the output will necessarily be less than the input, and we call that negative feedback. If g is greater than 0 but less than 1, the output will be greater than the input, and we call it positive feedback but stable. And if g exceeds 1, we have an instability in the system, and all bets are off. How do you calculate g? Well, it turns out there's a very simple first-order procedure for calculating it, which is good provided g isn't very, very close to 1. If g gets too close to 1, this won't work. But the method is to identify the feedback processes, which I've called PCBI, and then sum over all feedback processes, the partial of, let's say we're interested in global average surface temperature. So if you have an expression relating, say, global average surface temperature to the area of ice, we're looking now, for example, at ice albedo feedback. We would take the change in temperature due to a change in ice cover, which we could get from a climate model, and then we multiply by something which, if you've had partial derivatives, you know is not the inverse of this, even though it looks like it, the partial of ice cover with respect to temperature. And you can do that for carbon dioxide flux from ecosystems. You could do it for ice albedo, for anything you like. Sum over all the feedback processes, and you get the gain factor. Let's work it out. Before we work it out, let me just show you what it looks like if we ignore the Vostok data. We have a gain factor of 0.4 with this uncertainty range for the water vapor feedback. We have a gain factor of 0.09 from ice and snow albedo. And we have, with that range of uncertainty, and we have this value with a much bigger range, which even includes negative feedback for cloud feedbacks. And now if we take the full climate change, delta T, with the feedback, we're going to get the forcing effect divided by 1 minus G. The forcing effect is 1 degree. These feedbacks add up to 0.71. 1 minus 0.7 is 0.3. 1 over 0.3 is about 3. And so we get this projected warming of about 3 degrees. And that's where it comes from. It's really, you know, that's the science behind these rather obscure general circulation model projections. 3 feedbacks giving a gain factor of 0.7. Now, something interesting can be pointed out here. Let's say we want to add a new feedback to the 3 we've already looked at, a new feedback like ice albedo. Here we are. I'm calling 0 the current state of knowledge with a gain factor of 0.7. From doubling CO2, we get a temperature increase of about 3 degrees. Now let's suppose we have a new contribution to feedback, say from the carbon feedback that the Vostok core tells us about. Notice that the function 1 over 1 minus g is very asymmetric around the point g equals 0.71. If we increase up here to 0.3, this goes to infinity. If we decrease, it doesn't change that much. So an uncertain additional feedback is skewed more toward increasing temperature than decreasing. Now, if we know, in addition, that the new feedback we've ignored is a positive feedback, then we're moving along this side of the curve, and it's not even a question of whether the uncertainty is symmetric. We're going to be moving up here somewhere. So the question is, how far up that curve are we going to move? Here's the Vostok core data plotted as, on the y-axis, the CO2 level at the end, from the end of the last ice age to the present, against the temperature change. And what you see is a line with a slope of about 8 in these units, ppm degrees Celsius. And if we use that partial derivative formula, partial T partial CO2 from the general circulation model is 3 or 4 degrees over 275 parts per million. This is a very order of magnitude calculation, but it's illustrative. The slope of this is 32 parts per million per 4 degrees. The product gives a gain factor of 0.12. If I add the 0.12 to the 0.71, I get 0.83, and 1 over 1 minus 0.83 is 6 degrees instead of 3.4 degrees. So what happens is a small additional feedback can make a huge difference when the gain factor is already near 1. So how can we study where the carbon dioxide is coming from, this feedback carbon from that we know about from Vostok? And there are really two options. It's an oceanic process or it's a terrestrial process, because it certainly isn't outer space. So what are the options? Let's assume, because we don't know of an oceanic mechanism that can explain it, let's explore the possibility that it's got something to do with ecosystem responses to climate change. Well, there are many ways in which we can learn about feedbacks between climate and terrestrial ecosystems. We can look at ecological correlations across different climates. If you go up and down a mountain, you're going from warmer to colder, or back to warmer. And you can look and see how the carbon levels vary as you change climate along a natural climate gradient. We can do that in latitude or in altitude. We can also look at interannual variability of climate and see how carbon fluxes vary between hotter years and colder years. We can look at multi-decadal ecological trends, for example, associated with the North Atlantic Oscillation or the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. We can look at paleoclimatic variability, and we can learn about ecosystems from there, from the pollen record and other methods of reconstructing ecological conditions. So this is direct observation. Problem with direct observation is it doesn't tell you much about mechanism and causation. You may see patterns, but they may not be caused by the climate change. They may just correlate with the climate change. The way to get at causation is to do experiments. Then we have controls and treatments, and we can tease apart causal effects. And then we can put the information from these two sources into mathematical models to try to extend their generality. And each of these methods has limits. Models are only as good as the observations. Manipulation experiments are generally confined to smallish scales. Other than the giant experiment we're all doing with our planet, which has no control, if you're doing controlled experiments on the typical time frame and budget that ecology is done at, they're probably experiments done on experimental plots that are smaller than the size of this room. So you don't have a lot of regional generality coming out of these kinds of things. The observations can be done at large scales, but they may only tell you about correlation and not cause. Another aspect of this issue is at what scale should we be working? And ecologists tend to think about this at four levels. We can look at what's sometimes called the big green slime or smear model of the planet, where you just pretend all the life on Earth is one big leaf spread out over the Earth. And you don't distinguish the components of ecosystems, the different species. You don't see any of the rich variety of habitats and within habitat variety that ecologists revel in. This is one very coarse scale way of thinking. Then at a slightly finer scale, we can divide the whole planet into very coarse groupings, functional groups. So we might have the Sahara and Sahel as a group. We might have Amazonia. We might have the boreal forests of Canada as a group. And look at each of those as a lumped system. We might want to go to a finer scale and look at watershed scale processes shown here, or we might need to look at actual composition of a canopy in a forest. So this is a different species than this, and this. And they all do have different albedos, and so they're all affecting the climate in a unique way, and maybe if we're really unlucky, we have to go down to this resolution. And the question is, what can we do? What's the answer to that? Well, to begin to look at this, we set up, starting in 1990, an experimental warming at a field station in the Rocky Mountains on the western slope near Crested Butte. This is the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory. This is a profile of an experimental plot with overhead electric heaters shining 22 watts per square meter down on the plot. The plots are 3 meters by 10 meters. And the heaters have been on day and night, summer and winter, since 1990. And the effect of the heating, here you see the plots from one end looking across. The effect of the heating is to raise the temperature of the plants in the soil, to dry the soil, and to promote a longer growing season by causing snow to melt a couple of weeks early in the heated plots. Here you see a scene in spring. Heated plots have melted out. Between these two is a control plot, heated plot, control plot, and so forth. And this experiment has yielded a huge amount of data on how an ecosystem responds to climate. One of the effects has to do with species composition. Up here you can see two important species. This is sagebrush, Artemisia tridentata. We're near the upper elevational range of the sagebrush. It extends up another several hundred meters above us, but not much higher. And here we have a composite. We call these forbs. They're non-woody flowering plants. This is Erigeron speciosus, blooms in midsummer. And it's just one example of what are about 30 or 40 species of forbs in the plots. This is the dominant shrub in the plots. This is a woody plant. And what we've seen as a result of warming is that the forb, we can measure the growth rates of the plants or the aerial coverage of the plant, how much leaf area do they subtend. And by any measure, the forbs are doing poorly under heating and the sagebrush is doing better. This is some data from a colleague, David Inouye, showing that if you plot number of flowers on a forb, this is Delphinium nelsonii, you find it's a plant like this in the sense that it's shallow-rooted and it's a non-woody plant. You find that when snow melts late, you get much more flowering than when snow melts early. So snow melt, temperature, and moisture can affect which plants are dominant, and it's made a shift in the plant community composition. What's interesting is that in spring and early summer, the forbs have a higher albedo than the sagebrush. So lower albedo means they're darker. That means they absorb more sunlight. Sagebrush creates a climate favorable to its own growth. In fact, because it's an evergreen, as the snow melts down, the overwintering foliage acts like a radiation collector, causing pockets of warmth wherever there's a sagebrush sticking above the snowpack, and it can accelerate the melting of snow. So when we make a transition under heating from forbs to sagebrush, we're causing a positive feedback because we're going from bright and shiny plants to darker plants. So there's a positive feedback operating locally in this meadow, and we did some back-of-the-envelope calculations that suggest that the effect could be rather sizable. In fact, comparable over the long term to the direct effects of the heating. Another feedback that we looked at is methane consumption. Methane is a greenhouse gas, and it's both produced by microorganisms and, to some extent, it's destroyed by microorganisms. Methanogens create it. Methanotrophs eat it up. They oxidize it. They burn natural gas like we do, except they do it biologically. And we looked at the rate of methane uptake in our soil, in our plots, in heated and control plots. We found that the most explanatory variable to explain the rate at which methane is consumed, that is removed from the atmosphere by these microbes, is soil moisture. And we found that if you start out with a system with high soil moisture and you dry the soil, you will actually increase the amount of methane uptake. That's good, because you want to take as much methane out of the atmosphere as possible to reduce that greenhouse gas level, and that would create a negative feedback to global warming in the sense that if global warming dries the soils, as we expect, it will increase methane uptake if we're starting on this part of the curve. However, this is rare. That is, most of the time during the growing season, the plots are not found along this part of the curve. They're up here. And here, as you dry soils, you decrease the rate of methane uptake. The mechanisms are very different. We discovered that this is the result of reducing a barrier to the diffusion of methane in the soil. Soil moisture, when soils get very wet, blocks the passage of gases like methane through the soil. But when the soils are dry and you dry them further, you start to stress the methanotrophic bacteria. So this is a stress effect. This is a physical diffusion barrier effect. And the feedback depends on where you are. If you start out here and dry, you're going to get a positive feedback. If you start out here and dry, you get a negative feedback. If you started out here and you wetted the soil, you'd get, if global warming were to lead to wetter conditions, not likely in the Rockies, you would end up with a, instead now, a positive effect. And if global warming were to increase rain there, you would get a negative feedback. So things are complicated. Depends on where you start on the moisture curve and what warming is going to do to soil moisture, which is not as well predicted as what it will do to temperature. The last feedback is the carbon feedback. And here's what we observed in the plots. From the first measurements of soil carbon, we found that the control plot carbon levels in the soil bopped around a little bit, but there was no trend up through 1999. And the heated plot carbon levels plummeted and then leveled out. And actually, they've been pretty level for the up until now. Now we're in year 15, but I'm holding off on showing you the last 5 years for a reason. So warming resulted in a loss of carbon from the soil, a fair amount. And on a large scale, since soils hold about 5 times more carbon than the atmosphere, if you lose 20% of your soil carbon all over the world, that would be another doubling of soil carbon. Of atmospheric carbon. In other words, the soils hold enough carbon that if you just reduce the amount by 20%, that much carbon would double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So this could be a big deal, although we have no idea whether this is true all over the Earth. It's just true in our experiment. Question is, what's the mechanism? If we understand the mechanism, maybe we can generalize. What caused the decline in soil carbon? When we showed this result to people, they said, oh, yeah, it's obvious. You warm the soil, that speeds up microbial activity, and that means they're decomposing organic matter faster, and so you get that loss of carbon. But we did an experiment in the lab with 5 temperature conditions crossed with 5 moisture levels to get a temperature-moisture response surface. And what we found is that temperature going up increases decomposition, but moisture levels going down decrease decomposition. Both these occurred. Temperatures went up, moistures went down, in such a way as to cancel each other, and the actual rate of decomposition should not have changed, according to these lab results. And another way of getting at what might have happened is to look along a climate gradient. I mentioned observational work in a previous slide. If we look at the tops of mountains and the bottoms of mountains, we see carbon levels varying like this. But in our experiment, they went like this. This is the direction of gradient heating, that is natural heating along a landscape. This is what happened experimentally. So we're not going to learn about this by looking at patterns in the landscape. And so what's going on? Well, we hypothesized that the cause of this was really changing inputs of organic matter to the soil. Remember, there was a forb effect and a shrub effect. Turns out the grasses didn't respond to the warming. But we built a very simple three-box model of 3 kinds of plant matter entering soil in the form of dead plant matter, measured the decay constants for the different contributions to soil carbon using various methods, litter bag experiments and laboratory decomposition studies. So we have decay constants and we have inputs, and then it becomes a simple box model. And you can write the model in the form of a differential equation. And then you find that K this critical decay constant depends on temperature and moisture in such a way that these two cancel under the warming effect. But there's a litter quality effect because sagebrush litter turns out to have different decomposition characteristics from forb litter, and it creates a different kind of organic chemistry in the soil. But the biggest effect was the annual production of forbs was decreased much more than annual production of shrubs was increased. And so there was less input to the soil, and we looked at that model and compared it to in each plot of the warming experiment and the upper elevational sites, middle sites, the low sites. These vary in elevation by about 400 meters. And we found that all the soil carbon data was easily understood with that model. In particular, we explained 84% of the variance in the carbon data with a no parameter model. That is, there was nothing adjustable once we had done the measurements. So we felt like we understood what happened, and then we projected what should happen in the future. And according to that model, we should have seen a big decrease in soil carbon, but eventually we should see a recovery. The decrease was because there was less litter input to the soil because the forbs were hammered by the heating. But the sagebrush has more recalcitrant or stubborn litter. It's less decomposable. So in the long run, we projected an increase in soil carbon in the heated plots. It's a little bit like a bank account. Your bank account might decrease quickly if you put less money in. But if you leave it in that account longer, eventually it may recover and even overshoot. So what we have done is change the residence time of carbon in soil because of changing litter chemistry, and we've changed the input rates because of changing species composition. And that was our projection in 1999, that we would see a recovery. Here's what we actually saw. Carbon levels in the heated plots did not recover, but carbon levels in the control plots started around 2000 to come down. And now they're essentially indistinguishable from the heated plot levels. Why? Well, it turns out that from 1999 to 2004, the western United States, including the Rockies, had a drought. We had very low snowfall levels, early snowmelt, and in fact, the natural conditions that the control plots saw in these last 5 years, with the exception of this very last year, which was wet again, these years were very dry. And in fact, the control plots in these last 5 years looked a lot like the heated plots did in the first 5 years. And so we saw the effect of heating now from natural heating, the drought, causing a change in carbon levels that matched what we projected from that. And in fact, if you look at the shrubs and forbs, here's the wet period control plot forbs, heated plot forbs reduced. Here's the shrubs, control plot shrubs, heated plot shrubs. And now during the dry period, you can see the control plot forbs up here in the wet period, down here in the dry period, looking like the heated plot forbs. So this explanation of the carbon effect during the heating in the first 5 years allows us to come up with an unambiguous interpretation for the loss of carbon during the last 5 naturally dry years. It's the same effect showing up not as a result of an experiment, but as an effect of a regional change in climate. Now, one of the conclusions from all of this, well, one conclusion is that these feedbacks could be very important. And another is that the species really mattered. And in fact, we have many different kinds of forbs in these plots. Some of them are shallow-rooted, and some of them are deep-rooted. The deep-rooted forbs didn't respond to the heating. It was the shallow-rooted forbs that responded to the heating. Some of these forbs have rather delicious litter, easily decomposed, a low lignin to nitrogen ratio, and others have somewhat higher lignin to nitrogen ratio. So just in terms of those two variables, how decomposable is the litter and how responsive is the plant to the warming, we see four important species in these plots all behaving differently, all separated in one way or another by one or the other of these variables. Yet these two factors, the quality of litter and the carbon in the soil and responsiveness of the plant, are going to affect the strength of the feedback. So what can we do? Well, we can try to design a set of plant categories. And if you think about all the different properties of plants that could affect their response to climate, there's how productive are they? That is, how much carbon do they send to the soil at the end of each year? What's the chemistry of their foliage, their litter? How sensitive are they to climate change? Transpiration can matter, can affect the latent heat flow from the surface to the atmosphere. How much shading do they cause the soil? Albedo is up at the top. That's an important one. How rough is their canopy? All of these traits are plant traits that can affect how an ecosystem affects climate and how an ecosystem responds to climate and therefore the feedback. So that's a lot of categories. If you gave each category three levels, we'd have 729 plant categories. Just the first four, which we showed were important in the experiment, leads to 81 categories. The meadow itself only has 75 plant species, so we've got even more categories than we have plants to fill them. But this suggests an enormously complex situation, because if you don't understand those plant traits and how they differ across a landscape, it may be difficult to put together a believable regional, let alone global scale, projection of the size of the feedback. And that's one reason why I call this a daunting challenge. I'm not convinced that can't be overcome, but it's something that needs a lot more thought. But in addition, there are a lot of things we didn't look at in that experiment. We only looked at one habitat. We only looked at small scale. We didn't include large grazing animals. We didn't include enormously extreme events. We do have the drought, but there could be even more extreme events, which our 15-year experiment hasn't covered. We didn't increase the CO2 levels in these plots, and yet the CO2 levels are going up. Nitrogen deposition is occurring all over the planet. It's another global change. And we didn't add nitrogen to our plots to simulate the effect of increasing nitrogen deposition from human activity like fossil fuel burning and agriculture. We didn't include land use changes, which can also affect albedo and water exchange. We didn't look at the possible effect of invasive species. We didn't look at genetic differences from one population to another. And it may be that the Erigeron in our plots behave differently from the Erigeron down, say, at lower elevation. So there's an enormous amount of ecology and geography and other things that are not included in that experiment. But even that experiment led to a complex story. So what's the summary of all this? One is that the analysis of long-term climate records, the Vostok data, et cetera, show that strong positive feedbacks operate in Earth's climate system, and they're not now included in our models. Another is that an experimental warming provides more evidence for other feedbacks and may help to explain the carbon feedback that the Vostok core tells us about. The feedbacks we looked at were an albedo effect, a methanotrophic rate effect, and a carbon effect, loss of carbon from the soils going to the atmosphere of CO2. So there are feedbacks that our experiment in just 15 years revealed. Current climate models don't incorporate these feedbacks, and therefore, since most of these feedbacks are positive, we may be greatly underestimating the magnitude of future warming. and finally developing a global scale understanding of the sign and strength of the feedbacks is a huge challenge. Thanks. Happy to take questions.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, John. It was a great talk. Any questions for the speaker? I'll start at the back there.
You want to call?
Okay. No, yeah, in the new
you call.
Earlier in your presentation, you mentioned the fingerprints of warming climate. Now, both of you are considered in pushing land use change as a major driving of the warming instead of CO2. Now, in terms of land use change, is there a difference between these two forces?
The biggest difference, first of all, the person who's work you should read to get a really expert view of this is Roger Pilkey, Sr., a climatologist at Fort Collins. He does really good work on this whole question. Roger's work suggests that there are locations where the land use effect is even bigger than the global warming effect. But on a global average basis, a doubling of CO2 would be, or even the current 30% increase CO2 on a global average basis is having more impact than the land use changes. For one thing, the CO2 effect extends over the 70% of the Earth's surface where there is no land use, namely the oceans. And so it comes in with a kick as a result of that. There are places, however, like southern Florida and places where we've had huge loss of wetlands from deliberate drainage of wetlands, other things too, but places where we've cut down the forest and replaced it with sugarcane, where besides the CO2 contribution to global warming, there's a direct land use effect on climate because of the altered albedo of the land surface and the altered transpiration rate as a result of deforestation. So locally, the land use effects can be greater, but globally, the greenhouse signal appears to be greater.
Yeah, I think there's something like 100 times more CO2 dissolved in the oceans than there is in the atmosphere.
About 50 times.
50 times, okay. So what is the relative importance of warming the oceans and making CO2 less soluble versus the land?
Yeah, that's a really good and important question. If you ever studied the carbonate cycle, there's something called Henry's constant, which is temperature dependent, and it affects the equilibrium between the amount of carbon in the ocean and the amount in the air. And if you've ever gotten a nice bottle of beer out of the refrigerator, opened it, left it on the table, and then went and answered the telephone and came back later and it warmed up, you'd notice it was flat. It's warmer things lose carbon dioxide. So how important is that? It's a feedback that can be calculated using that exact same procedure I used here. And it turns out that it's not big enough to explain the Vostok carbon dioxide excursions. It would take considerably more than that to explain the CO2. It is a feedback. Some people have suggested that it's why Venus has 1,000 degree surface temperatures, huge quantities of carbon dioxide in its atmosphere, and no ocean. Perhaps once it had an ocean and then it had a runaway feedback. Now, Earth's ocean will not, at least under current parameters, have a runaway feedback. The numbers just don't work out right. The little G factor from that feedback over a time scale of about 1,000 years when the deep ocean has equilibrated with the surface ocean is more in the order of about 0.2 or 0.3. On a 1,000-year time frame, it could be huge, and if you add a G of 0.2 or 0.3 to the GCM G of 0.7, you're already right up there near 1. But that's on a 1,000-year time frame, and by 1,000 years, the CO2 from fossil fuel burning will have looked like a way in the past dimple on the CO2 record. It will have come and gone. But it's an important question, and there's still a lot of work to do on that. And I don't think we should be ignoring it, even in our current modeling. First of all, the whole presentation wasn't positive because there was a negative methanotrophic feedback. If you start out wet and you dry, you get a negative feedback. But the key thing about positive feedback is it works in whatever direction you're going. So if Milankovitch, which is the timekeeper of the glacial-interglacial variability, if Milankovitch starts to go into a reverse phase and decreases the effective solar flux on the Earth, then those same positive feedbacks accelerate the cooling. Positive doesn't mean hotter. It means more of whatever way you're headed anyway. So you have to rely on a combination of the timekeeper, namely the Milankovitch mechanisms, to trigger the turnarounds, and then the carbon feedback to accentuate the trend, whether it's cooling or warming. Yeah, I think you'd probably have to put grazing into that as well, or not. Are you thinking about areas that have been grazed?
It's mostly the fire that's driving.
My guess is that the fire, unless you attribute fire intensity and frequency to the climate change, but that's not what you had in mind.
Yeah.
I don't know of anybody who's looked at that as a climate-driven process.
Or the effect on the climate.
The effect on climate of that change has not been looked at either. Yeah. We're looking in California. We have an interesting situation. We had native perennial grasses, and they've been invaded over huge areas of California by European annuals. These were partly brought in deliberately because ranchers wanted that, and to some extent it's just spread accidentally. That effect of that transition appears to have an effect on carbon storage. And perennial grasses store more carbon in the soil than annuals. And it's not a huge effect, probably not big enough to. Not as big as the effects I showed you, but it's since it could be occurring over a large scale, because the annuals replacing perennials is a large regional transition, it may be that that's a contribution to change in the carbon cycle. You're talking about the deposition of carbon, say, in phytoplankton?
Yes.
To the seafloor? People look at that. It's not something I've looked at. One of the ideas that's been proposed for sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere is to add iron to the oceans, which will promote phytoplankton growth, especially in certain areas. Now, if that's all you do, you're not going to change the atmospheric CO2. Phytoplankton store something like 1/50th of the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. So you could triple the amount of phytoplankton in the ocean and barely make a dent in the amount in the atmosphere. What you have to do is have a sink. You have to take that newly photosynthesized carbon and get it out of harm's way down into the deep ocean where it won't decompose, or you hope it won't decompose. Then you can get a sink, and you could sequester a lot of carbon that way. The little bit I know about that topic from studies about how much additional carbon you can sequester by spiking seawater with iron suggests it's not likely to work. But that's the only carbon deposition phenomenon that I'm aware of, that people have looked at least.
Okay, well, I'd just like to close off the discussion, but just to let you know that John will be here tomorrow morning, so if you'd like to talk to him, we'll be up on the 7th floor at least to start in the morning. Just let us know, come by, and send me an email tonight if you'd like. Okay, so please join me in thanking John.